Our next case is Kim versus Parshall K. Tudor Hall Farm, LLC. Mr. Cook?
Hi, Your Honor. It's Koch.
I mispronounced it. Koch?
That's
fine. I'm sorry. Be pleased to hear from you, sir.
May it please the court. The issue in this case, essentially, from the Kim's point of view, and when I refer to Kim, I'm referring, of course, to all the 22 appellants here, is what is the correct amount of an equitable lien to be placed on a parcel of real estate in St. Mary's County, Maryland? It's known as Parcel K. Our position, Kim's position, that the amount of the lien should have been $3.12 million. And the district court, after correctly determining that a lien should be placed or a constructive trust should be placed on the property, incorrectly determined the amount of the lien and placed the lien in the amount of only $50,000. I want to make 3 points in this appeal argument, and realizing that there is actually a dearth of case law, despite diligent search for the case law, there's not much out there that applies directly to this case. However, there are equitable principles that a district court should have followed and did not follow in this case. The first argument is that the district court should have applied the doctrine of marshalling, the equitable doctrine of marshalling of assets. The doctrine of marshalling applies in this case. The second argument is that the district court's proportionality approach, which it applied to the determination of the lien, is inconsistent with the doctrine of marshalling and therefore was incorrect in this particular case. The third argument is that the district court made an erroneous factual determination in the context of a motion for summary judgment. In order to make that determination that the lien should be only $50,000, the court made a factual determination as to the amount of the investment monies that were used to purchase the entire Tudor Hall Farm property, how much should be applied to the Parcel K purchase. And there is conflicting evidence as to what that amount should be. There's the deed evidence, which the district court relied on, but there's also other evidence, which in this case was a operating agreement of the Parcel K LLC.
And in that regard, why shouldn't, if the case were remanded to the district court, why shouldn't the amount in the operating agreement be the figure to be?
Well, that would be our argument that, in fact, the deed consideration is incompetent or inadmissible evidence in any way, in any event, because it's conceded by the appellees, the LLC, that the deed consideration reflects the tax assessed value of this property back in 2005. It's well settled that tax assessed value is not evidence of fair market value, and fair market value would be the applicable measure for determining how much should have been allocated to this Parcel K. So I agree.
But the fact that it's put in a deed as consideration in a deed,
that's correct.
We're just to ignore that as opposed to just saying that the tax assessed value says 253?
Yes. Well, I'm not saying ignore it. I'm saying it's not admissible evidence under the facts of this case where it's admitted that the deed consideration simply reflects the tax assessed value. And moreover, you have a operating agreement of the Parcel K Tudor Hall Farm, which says that the value of the Parcel K for all purposes, and that's the exact language in the agreement, for all purposes, the agreement of the buyer and the seller at the time, for all purposes, the value of this property is $1 million. So I agree, it should be, I believe the court should have determined as an undisputed matter that the value of the property was $1 million. But if this court can't agree with that, well, there's a factual dispute. That must be determined as a matter of fact. Should the deed have been, the appropriate consideration, or should the operating agreement of Parcel K?
So that's what you're saying, it should be $1 million?
Should be $1 million, absolutely, Your Honor.
And what about, you get 20% of it?
The proportionality applied by the district court is inappropriate in this case. The doctrine of marshalling should apply. Marshalling doctrine is, it employs the legal fiction that where you have commingled assets, in this case, there was a commingling. Let there be no doubt, there was a commingling. Kim's funds were combined with the funds of other investors and the funds of the SunChase 11 promoter of this deal to buy an entire farm, the Tudor Hall Farm. As a result of a Chapter 11 bankruptcy, 7 of the 8 parcels are gone. They are transferred, administered in the Chapter 11 case. So all we have left now is Parcel K. That is the type of situation where the doctrine of marshalling applies. The doctrine of marshalling employs the legal fiction that only trust funds were used to buy that Parcel K or to acquire that Parcel K where the majority of the trust res, in this case the rest of the farm, has been dissipated. Now, the marshalling doctrine applies to any kind of property. The district court was under the misapprehension, I believe, and also the appellees in this case have argued that the marshalling doctrine only applies to bank accounts. But this court's own case law, and we cite the McBride case in the briefs, says that the marshalling doctrine applies to any kind of property where there's been a commingling or combination of funds, and now you have just a small amount left of the property, and that small amount significantly is insufficient to pay the claimant's claims in full.
So that's how you get to your $3+ million.
Well, if you step back, I don't think it's necessary to do an allocation, how much was applied to Parcel K as opposed to the rest of the farm, because in the original sale transaction, there was no allocation. So my position would be that it's not necessary to make an allocation, that the entire $3.12 million investment by Kim attaches to or can be identified in Parcel K, and there's really no need to do an allocation. However, I'm not saying it's not an unreasonable thing to make an allocation, and if that is this court's decision, that an allocation is either necessary or not unreasonable or should be determined, I'm saying, well, $1 million is the amount that should be allocated to it. But also in this case, I think it's well to keep in mind that the Kims invested $3.2 million. The value of Parcel K, we don't know because we haven't had a factual determination on that yet. Perhaps on a remand, an appraisal testimony could be helpful in this kind of situation. But
so what are you asking us to do? Remand it and have evidence taken and get appraisal expert testimony and find out what Parcel K is worth?
I'm asking this court to reverse the order insofar as it determines the lien amount to be $50,000. I'm asking this court to—
I understand. You don't like the $50,000.
We don't like the $50,000. That's right. Our number one position here is instruct the court that the value of the property undisputedly is $1 million. And that is the amount to be allocated to a Parcel K.
Your first position is vacate to $50,000 and give you $1 million.
Well, actually, it's give us I misspoke, I'm sorry. Give us a lien of $3.12 million because allocation not even necessary. However, if you decide that allocation is necessary, it's $1 million.
So the first position is it's $3.12 million.
That's correct.
First fallback position is it's $1 million.
That's correct.
Is there another one?
It's not, no, I wouldn't call it a fallback.
And to get to that, any of that, to get to the million, you got to have a hearing and further evidence?
I don't believe it's necessary. I believe
we can rule on that, on this record.
I don't believe it's necessary to have further hearings as to the value of Parcel K if this court agrees that it's undisputed that when it was written in the operating agreement that the value for all purposes is $1 million, that's undisputed and that's the value. I can live with that.
The operating agreement everybody agreed to said it's $1 million.
It does. It does. But again, the second piece of it is that the
market disregards the proportionality rule. $1 million.
Well, the first step is what's the property worth? It's worth $1 million. Then you get to the next question. Well, do we have to apply some sort of proportionality test?
If you proportion that, then what do you come out with?
I come out with 25%.
$250,000.
That's if the court goes that way, and that's
I'm just seeing how many alternatives you're putting on the table here.
Yeah.
You start with $3.12 million, and that's your preference.
Yeah.
Then $1 million, and that's your next preference, and then $250,000, which you wouldn't like.
Yeah, where I get the 25% is, and it's I do the arithmetic in the brief. I take the Kim's investment as a percentage of the total Class A investments. The district court came up with 20%. I think they took the Kim's investment as a total, as a percentage of the total purchase.
Let me interrupt. Go ahead, Judge.
If we're getting into that situation, we'd have to remand and have the court determine whether it's 20% or 25%.
If that's an issue, yes.
Well, I mean, it is an issue.
I think that can be decided as a matter of law. Frankly, you have the.
To do that, we'd have to take your word for it.
I don't believe so. I think it's undisputed in the record that as to the amount, total amount of the Class A investments and what the Kim's percentage is, that's arithmetic.
If you decide it's 20, then you get $200,000.
That's correct.
That's another number.
At that point, it's arithmetic.
And we're down to four numbers.
Yeah.
Let me ask you a question. If there's a question, in fact, as to the value of Parcel K, what date would be the date used for the determination of the value?
That would be the date of the sale, Your Honor. Back in 2000, it was May 1st of, I may be off by a day or two, but it was May of 2005. It's well-established case law and applicable to constructive trusts that you look at the circumstances at the time of the transaction, subsequent circumstances, subsequent transactions are irrelevant, so that would be my position. If there are no further questions, I'm done.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Mr. Metz?
May it please the court, my name is Stephen Metz, and I represent Parcel K Tudor Hall Farm, LLC, which is both the appellee and a cross-appellant in this case. The issues pending in this case are two, essentially. One is whether the district court should have imposed a constructive trust in the first instance over Parcel K. And the second issue is the dollar amount of the constructive trust lien if the district court was correct in imposing it in the first place. In a broad sense, the case involves the scope of a court's power to impose a constructive trust. We submit, as I think you know, that the facts of this case do not support that remedy.
But you want us to vacate the constructive trust?
That's correct, Your Honor. That's correct. We believe that the district court erred by imposing the constructive trust in the first place, which is our cross appeal, and that the district court should have denied the plaintiff's summary judgment motion that granted and granted our summary judgment motion, thereby entering judgment in favor of Parcel K Tudor Hall Farm on plaintiff's constructive trust count, which was count five of their complaint.
Well, isn't it true that the only asset out there that the, I guess, appellants can get their hands on is the Parcel K?
Well, we don't think that they can based upon, I assume you're asking that because of what happened in the bankruptcy proceeding.
It wasn't subject to the bankruptcy.
Well, we sort of disagree with that because we think the bankruptcy plan that was confirmed, which is one of our points as to why the district court erred, that the bankruptcy plan that was confirmed barred I'll call them the plaintiffs, the Class A members, from seeking to impose a constructive trust over Parcel K. And since I'm talking about that, I'll just get right to that argument. The bankruptcy plan here talked about, it permanently enjoined all Class A members from commencing direct or indirect causes of action against Tudor Hall Funding. Tudor Hall Funding was the secured creditor in the bankruptcy case. Tudor Hall Funding owns 100% of the interests in Parcel K Tudor Hall Farm LLC. It acquired 80% of those interests in conjunction with the confirmation of the Chapter 11 plan. And then it acquired 20% by paying the owner of that 20%, which was Tudor Hall Farm, Inc., which was the seller of the property in the first place. So our position is that this claim to impose a constructive trust where Tudor Hall Funding ended up acquiring all those interests in conjunction with that plan that was confirmed, which was disclosed to all of the parties, to the Class A members. It was disclosed that Parcel K Tudor Hall Farm owned Parcel K. All that was disclosed in the disclosure statement. Nobody objected. And it's our position that that was an indirect claim against Tudor, that the constructive trust claim is an indirect claim against Tudor Hall Farm, sorry, Tudor Hall Funding. Sorry, there's so many Tudor Halls in this case. Tudor Hall Funding, and that was barred under the confirmed plan. Now, the other reasons why we think that the district court erred in imposing a constructive trust in the first place, our main position, I would say, is that the plaintiff had the burden to prove that money, that their money was traced, could be traced to Parcel K, and they failed to do that. The case law is very clear that before a court can impose a constructive trust, a plaintiff must establish by clear evidence that his or her funds, that specific funds, can be traced to the account or the property over which they to impose a constructive trust. Now, the district court recognized correctly that both parties rely on the language of the agreement of sale where all of the property, the parcels that were acquired by SunChase, the debtor that ultimately went into bankruptcy, which were 7 parcels, as well as this Parcel K, the district court realized that both parties rely on the language of this agreement. And it's important to focus on that language because it says, quote, notwithstanding anything to the contrary contained herein, at the closing, seller, which was Tudor Hall Farm, Inc., shall contribute out Parcel K to a newly formed buyer-affiliated limited liability company, which was defined as the out Parcel K owner, for no additional payment. And then it goes on to say, seller, Tudor Hall Farm, Inc., will have a capital account in such outparcel K owner equal to the fair market value of outparcel K and be entitled to a 20% membership interest in the outparcel K owner, which is my client, Tudor Hall Farm, LLC, Parcel K Tudor Hall Farm, LLC.
What do you do about Gebhardt Investment? The Maryland case says that LLC folks don't have any interest in the property. They only have interest in the LLC.
I assume you're asking that question in connection with the indirect argument that I made a minute ago.
Right.
And that is the case that Judge Williams cited in his opinion. And I think there's no question that the members of an LLC are different from the LLC. I mean, that's essentially what Gebhardt says. But based upon the facts and circumstances, I don't think that case controls whether the claim for a constructive trust is an indirect claim against Tudor Hall Funding or not. I mean, the question is, all right, in the context of that confirmed Chapter 11 plan where Tudor Hall Funding acquired 100% of the membership interests in Parcel K Tudor Hall Farm LLC, where it was disclosed that Parcel K Tudor Hall Farm LLC owned that property. It was disclosed that in the plan that the membership interest, 80% of it, would go to Tudor Hall Funding. I think in that context, and you have to look at it in that context, that was an indirect claim, notwithstanding the fact that, yeah, an LLC member is different from the LLC. Now, getting back to the tracing argument, I don't think there's any question that language in the sales agreement shows that that this parcel was contributed by the seller, Tudor Hall Farm, Inc., to my client at the closing. Also, my client's operating agreement that was dated May 2nd, 2005, indeed reflects that Tudor Hall Farm, Inc. did contribute Parcel K to the entity as its capital contribution in exchange for the 20% interest. And by contrast, the record also reflects that SunChase, which was the entity that acquired all the other parcels, contributed $100 in exchange for its 80% interest. Now, the district court attempted to get around the plain language by relying on one of the recitals in the agreement, which stated that SunChase, quote, desired to purchase all these various parcels. However, the district court's reliance on the recital is contrary to applicable contract construction law. I mean, the case law is clear that you look to the operative part of the agreement to find out what the parties actually did. You don't rely on a mere recital. The effect is supposed to be given to the obligatory part if there's any inconsistency between the recitals and the actual contract terms. One of the cases that I cited, which was the Pulaski case, that case talked about, there was a recital that talked about, quote, all property rights, end quote. And then there was an issue, I think, whether the dower rights were included in that. And the court said, no, you look to the actual operative part of the agreement, not to the recital. The district court also wrongly construed the meaning of the no additional payment. I don't think you even need to get to that issue based upon the plain language of the contribution of it. But the district court interpreted it as saying that the parties meant no additional payment over and above the $15.5 million already being paid for all parcels, including Parcel K. But how could it mean that when it said that Parcel K was being contributed by the seller? No additional payment meant that the seller wasn't receiving a payment for Parcel K, in addition to what it was getting paid for the other parcels, because the seller was contributing Parcel K to Parcel K Tudor Hall Farm, LLC, as its capital contribution. The second reason why we say that the constructive trust should not have been imposed in the first instance is because even if you could find tracing, then summary judgment shouldn't have been granted in favor of the plaintiffs, because there was a dispute of fact as to sort of the basis for imposing any constructive trust, which is, you know, fraud, wrongdoing, unjust enrichment, some facts. Now, I'm going to run out of time before I address my cross appeal, so I'll just mention this briefly. There are lots of facts that question whether there was really fraud in the case, including the lead plaintiff's admission in a filing with the bankruptcy court that said she was, quote, sure that Mr. Nice didn't mean to mess up like this, but he was unfortunate that WCI withdrew due to Hurricane Katrina. Basically, she was saying she didn't think Mr. Nice meant to harm them, but the deal failed because WCI, which had, after the sale, contracted to buy all the property for $26 million, pulled out of the deal. As opposed to, the reason I'm not getting my money is because you defrauded me. There's testimony where in depositions where the plaintiffs are saying, yeah, I read the confidential summary of offering. That confidential summary of offering says, yeah, this parcel is not going to be titled in the name of SunChase. Now, moving on to the whole dollar amount of the constructive trust lien. We're dealing in this case with a total of 8 parcels that were acquired at the same time. The district court adopted, as you know, this proportionality approach, which essentially it was based on logic. But it wasn't unsupported by case law. Even there's a case out of the Court of Special Appeals of Maryland, the Jonagan case. It, not that it's about this issue, but it discusses the use of proportionality test under similar circumstances where you're talking about money going into a property where that wasn't all the money that was used to purchase the property. Now, Mr. Koch mentioned before the whole commingled account commingled property test. This is, we don't think this is a commingled case. This is a fundamental tracing case. The issue is, can they trace their money to this particular property? Okay? Now, the commingled property cases use this fiction, okay, that basically says, and it's discussed in all the lowest intermediate balance test cases, which basically says somebody's money is combined in an account or maybe even in something else. And then money is taken out, or property is taken out of that. And the fiction is that non-trust money is taken out first, leaving the so-called trust money in there. That has nothing to do, those cases have nothing to do with what happened here. Now, so we know that plaintiff's money was used to purchase the other properties. I mean, it had to be. There's no dispute there. Obviously, our position is that none of their money was used to purchase parcel K under our cross appeal because it was contributed. So I guess the bottom line is, if courts can use a fiction under the lowest intermediate balance test cases, then certainly a fiction can be used in this case too, where we do know the consideration recited in the respective deeds. Judge Harwell said, well, what about the $253,200 recited in the deed? You know, it's not a question of what was the tax assessed value of it, it's what did the deed say? Now, yeah, we agree, I concede that we say no money was put in there, and that's our cross appeal, okay? But if you're gonna get beyond that and say, okay, fine, we should have imposed a constructive trust, then you're talking about, okay, what was in the record? Okay, yeah, there was a deed that said $253,200. And then after that, it just became math, okay? And, you know, the case law says with constructive trust, the imposition rests on the discretion of the court. It follows that how exactly the remedy is imposed should also rest on the discretion of the court in its quest to make an equitable allocation.
So you're saying that amount of the lien was a discretionary call, and we review it for abuse of discretion?
Yes. Yes. I mean, we don't think there should have been any lien in the first place, but
I understand all that.
You've got to get there.
But assume that if the lien's properly there, you want the amount, $50,000, sustained.
Yes. Yes, that's correct.
So you say the judge Williams got that part of it right.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
Looks like my time is up.
Your time is up. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
Mr. Koch?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. On that point of discretion, whether the district court has discretion, the district court does not have discretion to make erroneous legal determinations, and in failing to apply the marshalling doctrine, the equitable doctrine of marshalling, which has been fully endorsed by this court, that was legal error. To put it another way, if the abuse of discretion standard applies to any aspect of this case, an erroneous legal determination is an abuse of discretion. So I think that's the response to Mr. Mitz's argument on that particular point. As to his argument on the proportionality approach of the district court, there's absolutely no case law precedent for what the district court judge did in this case, and the case that the district court relied on was a unreported Delaware decision, which has absolutely no factual comparison to the facts before this court. That Delaware case was a case where the assets had appreciated in value, and the argument was whether the plaintiff, the claimant in that case, was going to get a windfall profit, essentially, if an entire piece of property were impressed with a constructive trust. And the court said, I think appropriately in that case, well, we're not going to give the plaintiff a windfall. We're just going to give the plaintiff reimbursement for their actual loss. That's not the case here, where the trust res, which is parcel K, is worth less. Whatever it's worth, we don't know. It could be $1 million, it could be $600,000, $200,000, whatever. We don't know at this point because there hasn't been a factual determination. But I think we can safely say that it's worth less than $3.12 million. So in other words, whatever the value is, Kim is not going to be reimbursed in full, and we're not arguing about a windfall, a potential windfall going to the Kims.
That's, you spent most of your time talking about the money in this case. How about the bankruptcy issue?
Yes, Your Honor. I think they're actually can be responded to relatively shortly. On the issue of the arguments made, well, this property, Parcel K, was contributed for no consideration. Well, I think the district court got this one right. Tudor Hall Farm, Inc., the seller, would not have contributed Parcel K to Parcel K, LLC, if there had not been agreement for the purchasers to pay $15 million for the entire property. Now, on that point, in the sale agreement itself, the definition of the property includes all of the parcels. It includes all of them, parcel A through K, and there were eight parcels. They're all included in the definition of the property, and the consideration recited in the deed for all of the property is the $15 million. So you get to this one paragraph, which says that parcel K is going to be contributed to a new entity for no additional consideration. Well, I think the only interpretation of that, I don't think there's any ambiguity there. The no additional consideration means no consideration in addition to $15 million. It doesn't mean it's being, the parcel is being contributed for no consideration at all. On the other point, whether the bankruptcy plan enjoins or prohibits this this litigation. One, Parcel K LLC was not a debtor in the SunChase 11 bankruptcy case. Parcel K was not an asset of the SunChase 11 bankruptcy case. Parcel K was not administered in the Chapter 11 bankruptcy case. The section of the bankruptcy plan that Mr. Metz cites, section 6.4 of the plan, prohibits lawsuits against Tudor Hall funding. There is absolutely no factual basis before this court in the record, on the summary judgment record, there's absolutely no basis for reaching a factual determination that somehow this is an indirect claim against Tudor Hall funding because subsequently Tudor Hall funding acquired, subsequent to the purchase in 2005 of this property, Tudor Hall funding several years later purchased all the membership interests in Parcel K LLC. But there's no factual basis for concluding that a claim against Parcel K LLC is somehow an indirect claim against funding because, as was pointed out earlier, the membership interest in an LLC is distinct from the property of the LLC. So that would be essentially my response to that that argument. Also, not only does the SunChase plan prohibit lawsuits against Tudor Hall funding, whereas this is a case against Parcel K LLC, the plan, I believe, also only prohibits claims that could have been asserted by SunChase 11. But for the Chapter 11 bankruptcy, SunChase 11, along with Nice and Nice and Company, would have been a defendant. They were a perpetrator of the fraud in this case. SunChase 11 could not assert the interests of the investors against Parcel K LLC. So for those reasons, the injunction provision of the plan, I believe, is inapplicable, and I believe the district court was correct. As far as the fraud, I heard that argument made. There's simply nothing in the record that creates a factual dispute on the fraud, on the fraud issues. So with that, if there are no further questions, I've said everything.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll come down, Greek Council, and take a short break.
You have
some more time.
I think I have five minutes.
I'm sorry. That's right. Cross appeal. I apologize to you, sir.
Promise I'll say something.
Help yourself.
Helpful.
Look forward to hearing from you.
All right. Thank you, Your Honor. I will address a couple issues that Mr. Koch just. Number one, We keep talking about the value of the property at some time, whether it was at the time that it was parcel K was transferred to parcel K Tudor Hall Farm or now, or and there's some question of when, which do we use and all that. Bottom line with that is, I don't think value has anything to do with the issues. I mean, the question is tracing how much money that came from the plaintiffs can be traced to that particular piece of property. I'm not sure what the relevance of value is in trying to figure that out. With respect to, Mr. Koch said before that Tudor Hall Farm Inc. wouldn't have contributed the parcel K to the LLC had it not been paid the other $15.5 million. I'm not sure whether that's relevant either, because the bottom line is it did contribute parcel K to parcel K Tudor Hall Farm Inc. for a 20% interest in that LLC, which it got, and it was valued at the that LLC interest, and it got a capital count for $1 million, which was based upon the fair market value of what contributed. No money was received from that transaction. Now, turning to the bankruptcy issue and whether the constructive trust claim is barred by the confirmed bankruptcy plan. One of the issues is, could the constructive trust remedy have been brought on behalf of the debtor's estate? Because the confirmed plan says that claims that are barred are, again, direct or indirect claims that could have been brought against funding that could have been brought on behalf of the debtor or the debtor's estate. So the issue is, could a constructive trust claim have been brought on behalf of the debtor's estate? In essence, the plaintiffs are saying that SunChase, which was the debtor in bankruptcy that acquired all the other parcels, that SunChase essentially acquired all of the parcels, including parcel K. I mean, they're relying on the recital of the agreement that says SunChase desires to acquire all these parcels. So, not that I agree with that, but under their theory of the case, if you believe what they say, then SunChase could have sought to impose a constructive trust over parcel K for its benefit. And under the Cadel versus Moore Fifth Circuit case, that is considered to be property of the state. And the bottom line with this issue is they can't have it both ways. If they want to allege that parcel K was acquired with the same money that acquired the other parcels, well, then they're bound by the plan injunction. If they want to allege that parcel K is different, which we say it is, then they can't trace any of their money to it. So I think either way they lose. Unless the court has any other questions, I will.
Well, let me ask you this.
Yes.
Paragraph 16 of the agreement for sale, doesn't it contradict the recitals and paragraph 1?
I don't believe it does contradict. Maybe it contradicts the recital, because the recital says something like SunChase desires to purchase all this property.
But would you agree that if it's an ambiguity between paragraph 1 and paragraph 16, and the recitals are clear, the court has a right to rely on the recital?
I don't think. One second. Number one, it doesn't contradict paragraph 1. I'm not sure what paragraph. I mean, paragraph 1 says the purchase price for the property, it talks about the property, I suppose, which was defined.
It contradicts the whereas clause. Is that?
Well, I understand I understand the question. I guess the question is, you're saying if in paragraph 1, when it says the purchase price for the capital P property shall be $15 million, which was ultimately changed to $15.5 million,
and parcel K is included in that.
And parcel K is included in the definition of property from. Let's see. Actually, I'm. Well, not sure that's true, because The whereas clause talks about these various parcels, A, B, C, E, F, G, H, I, J, and K, and defines that as real property. Paragraph 1 talks about property. So I'm not sure that there is a contradiction between paragraph 1 and paragraph, I believe, 16, which makes it, which is very specific, okay, that this outparcel K is going to be contributed. With respect to comparing paragraph 16 of the actual agreement and the recital, which simply says so-and-so desires to do something, I think the case law is clear that the operative part, paragraph 16, controls, notwithstanding that there may be some inconsistency between that and the recital. So I hope that answers your question. If there are no more questions, I will ask that the court.
Thank you very much, sir.
Okay, thank you.
Let me try this again. We're going to come down and greet counsel and take a short break.